Housing for the Aged Action Group, HAG for short, a housing group for older people run by old people. Present
Raise the Roof!
We advocate for secure, affordable and appropriate housing. So listen up on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 5:30pm on 3CR 855 on your AM dial.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Raise the Roof, brought to you by Housing for the Aged Action Group. We're here on Wurundjeri country. My name's Liz. I'm here with Fiona. How are you, Fiona?
I'm good, Liz. How are you going?
Yeah, not too bad. It's nice to have a little bit of sunshine on the 22nd of April. It's been a rather sunny day this week, sunny week this week. And so this week we have got an interview with Therese Hall, who has just finished doing a PhD, which will be available soon, and she's interviewed older women about their experiences with finding housing. So women who are looking for social housing and in housing precarity and at risk of homelessness.
Radio.
Hello, and so we're here interviewing Dr. Therese Hall, who's just completed a PhD with the Institute of Culture and Society at Western Sydney University. How are you, Therese?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks very much for being interviewed by us today on the Raise the Roof program. So tell us a bit about yourself and your research.
Well, I'm a 66-year-old single parent. I've got four daughters. Ranging from 38 down to 25. I've always worked as a journalist in the past, but I have studied on and off throughout my life. Obviously, I've cared for my children. I've also cared for an ailing mother as well. I set off on a later life study trajectory when I was about 55, and I started a Master's of Research in Anthropology at Macquarie. And when I was doing that, I stumbled upon an episode of SBS Insight about older women who became homeless later in life for the first time. And for my master's, I investigated the experience of housing precarity for older women. That was in 2019. And then for my PhD at Western Sydney Uni, which I finished last year, I extended that topic to investigate the experiences of those precariously housed women seeking support. Like, where do they go? Who do they turn to? Mm. Rather than other people deciding who they turn to, I wanted to ask them, as the experts, because I've got the lived experience of being precariously housed, who do they actually turn to?
Yeah.
I did my field work in 2023, and I did it in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales. About a third of my participants, there was 36 participants, about a third of them came from the Lismore area, many of whom were flood affected. Mm-hmm. About a third came from like the Byron Bay, Mullumbimby, more coastal areas, which is very overpriced because of the tourism industry. And then the last third came from the Gold Coast. These women were between mid-40s and early 80s, and I talked to each of them for about 90 minutes, usually over lunch or a coffee in a cafe.
And so what were some of the main things that you found in your research?
Well, after undertaking the interviews, I found kind of three different streams of support that they were seeking. Mm-hmm. So firstly, and often first up, they turned to their families and mm-hmm. friends when things got really tough. So some of these women were still in rental properties, but they were beyond, at a price that was beyond their income. Mm. Because most of them, the women I spoke to, were on government payments, like JobSeeker, disability, or the pension, the age pension. So many of them turned to their family first, particularly their adult children. But they often found that the support offered by families and friends was quite unreliable.
Yeah.
Not that they didn't want to help, mm-hmm. but they often couldn't do anything long term, or they felt they couldn't do anything long term.
Yeah, so it's a temporary stopgap type solution. Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed to have a sense of timeliness around it. Yes, you can couch surf for a couple of months, but after that, you've got to go your own way.
Start outstaying your welcome and feeling uncomfortable.
Yes, yes. A lot of that kind of caregiving, care receiving created a lot of complexity, relational complexity for the women, especially when they were asking for care from people they used to care for, like their children.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing reading in the preparation for this interview. You were talking about this kind of the age aspect where, yeah, some of the adult children, yeah, really not feeling ready to be supporting their parents, their mums.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because most of my participants were in their 50s and 60s. The majority were there, and the outliers were the bit younger and the bit older. And I think adult children just aren't prepared for mum to need their help at that age.
For sure.
Whereas if mum comes along later, I think they're more mentally geared up to help mum.
Yeah.
You know, because it's more of an expectation.
Also probably physically better set up as well. So
yeah.
I'm assuming the adult children you're talking about might also be in their 20s, some of them.
Yes. Yeah. Or if they're in their 30s, they've got children and they're very caught up with bringing those children up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really busy time for people in that midlife period. Well, they call it the sandwich generation, don't they?
Yeah, mm-hmm. they do. Mm-hmm. And you also found that people were trying to get help from the welfare sector. And that's something that's and that's something that's really close to our heart too, is how difficult it is for older people to navigate that. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about what the people you interviewed found when they reached out to the welfare sector?
Well, I think a lot of them felt quite challenged when they approached the welfare sector. They felt like their needs were sort of diminished by the staff members.
Mm.
Their degree of homelessness was often questioned because these women often, or the women that I was looking at, weren't roofless.
Yeah.
So they had a roof over their heads, even if that was somebody's couch, a friend's couch. And that meant that they weren't deemed homeless enough. And also it's because they're being compared to people who are living on the streets or, you know, people with families, with young children, might be DV victims. They seem to, you know, go up the waiting list, because basically everyone's looking for some sort of social housing to get them out of this fix because of the expense, you know, the affordability of housing. There's also, if they're in marginal housing, which a lot of them were, which you'd call housing that's not an acceptable level, either it's too small, it's too crowded, it's too expensive. The services sort of made assumptions that they're able to cope because they're doing that. And one of my participants felt that she was really disadvantaged, although she was in her early 80s, because she was using her initiatives by couch surfing with a friend.
Mm.
She couch surfed for 2 years. Because otherwise she'd be living in a car, and she was determined not to live in a car. But she felt that if she lived in her car, she would have been offered something.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a catch. And also there were assumptions about their care networks, that have you asked your children? Can't you go turn to a friend? Which I'm not sure whether other cohorts have faced that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you also found that people were looking out for each other a lot too. And so being able to kind of have that community solidarity between themselves. And I know that particularly the Northern Rivers has got a strong history of grassroots activism as well. Is that what you were finding when you were speaking to the women up there? Yeah.
Yes, that was. I actually found that across the board in the three regions I looked at, but I found different types of what we could call communal solidarity mm-hmm. or modes of advocacy. So in the Lismore area, the women were quite, you know, loud about their protests. There was a lot going on with, you know, the floods, and there was a lot of housing that could have been used that was deemed unsafe. You know, that was a very particular set of circumstances there where houses were left vacant, where people were on the street. So women were really leading a lot of kind of protests there, older women. And then in the Byron, Mullumbimby sort of area, there was where there's a lot of history, and both those areas, a lot of history of intentional housing communities.
Mm.
There were lots of ideas around reimagining housing and better systems that could suit more people without it being all about how much you can afford. But then particularly in the Gold Coast area, women were very active on social media sites like Facebook groups in looking for share housing.
Yeah, yeah.
And offering support to each other. Some women who had a room were offering it to others, mm-hmm. often because they needed the funds to afford the place they were in because mm-hmm. of rent increases. And other women who were either about to lose their rental or were living in stopgap situations would think about moving in with them. But this was very problematic. It wasn't highly successful.
The share housing.
But it was one of the ways, it was one of the ways women were trying to make things happen on their own mm-hmm. without the support, like more of a grassroots sort of action.
Yeah. And so with all of these interviews and the themes that were emerging out of the research, what was the thing that you found most surprising?
Surprising is probably the wrong word, but the fraughtness of the family relationships was very moving. There was a lot of stress and unease around that. And it wasn't that the children were rejecting them. You know, it's not that simple. It's not like they're just turning their backs. It's just they have a lot of issues that they can't deal with, usually around the cost of housing and, you know, childcare and all the things they're dealing with. So that was really difficult. And also getting behind the sort of research we've seen that the welfare agencies are not giving the right sort of support for older people.
Yeah.
Just getting those, what they're actually experiencing, you know, the actual experiences of when they go up to the desk, what they get told was very interesting.
Yeah.
And I think the third area, which is the advocacy, well, that was very surprising because that's like an emerging phenomenon for older women to be so involved in making things happen for themselves in this type of advocacy.
Yeah, it seems like this came up quite a bit in your interviews, that perhaps for the first time the women that you're interviewing, it may have been the first time that they had really advocated to the government about housing and homelessness or about anything. Was that right?
Yes. I think some of them, in having the conversation, were forming these ideas for the first time, whereas others had obviously been talking amongst themselves and they were quite adept at strategising things. But others, you could see it was happening. And over time, in my relationships with those women, I watched them emerge as advocates.
Yep. And I guess it's a bit of a tension about, you mentioned also that a lot of older women prefer to remain out of sight, but then there's this other side of the coin where they're being quite loud and vocal about their housing needs as well. I guess that's something that we as a community can build upon too, in terms of galvanising that that spark that's been fired up in people's bellies, I guess, around trying to change the system.
And some of, I mean, the type of advocacy that was going on online in my thesis, I called it quiet advocacy because they're not, you know, the classic protesters, but they're still doing the advocacy, even talking about their situation to their family or friends, actually coming clean is a type of advocacy. And a lot of them were coming clean for the first time, and it does affect relationships.
Well, overcoming that stigma too and that shame around that, and the blame that people put on themselves is a big thing. So speaking of advocacy and trying to make change, what do you think needs to change in terms of improving the situation for older women and housing precarity?
Well, I guess the first thing is, you know, enough social housing.
Yeah.
So that, I guess it's like not turning your back on women who are living in such poor conditions and are under so much stress. Like, we're almost normalising it by not, because we can't respond to it properly because of the under investment in social housing, we're letting it happen.
Yeah.
And letting it happen, it lets them feel like they're not important, that they don't matter.
Yeah.
So, yes, we all know it's the same thing, you know, the need for the housing resources.
Yeah.
But I think if they could be treated differently when they do front up, if they could be received by people who have a proper knowledge of their situation, I think it would be really useful.
Perhaps something like a Home at Last service in other states.
So for services, for services to be more in tune with the experiences and the needs of older people and older women and their situations that are unique and different from people looking for housing from different age groups.
One of my participants who went to put her name down on the waiting list for social housing for the first time, and she was in her 70s. She was given a caseworker, which she appreciated, but she explained that this caseworker, what she said was, she didn't get where I was coming from. She couldn't get my age. She couldn't get my needs, and she was triggering my PTSD. And she felt like she needed something a bit more specialised. So that was a really nice, like, explanation of how it feels wrong to them sometimes if they're not heard.
And also what you were saying earlier about there might not be any other complexities. They may not be fleeing family violence, or they may not be rough sleeping. So they do get deprioritised in the system because the demand is so high. And, they do become a little bit more invisible.
Because their issue is their poverty, basically. And their poverty leads to, you know, that edge of homelessness where they're, I mean, this is a prevention space if we're going to advocate for prevention, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Before they actually are on the street. And because these women are very, they often tap into an identity of being very competent and, you know, being able to organise their own lives. They've, most of them have brought up children on their own, because most of them have been through a marriage breakup earlier in life, which has set them on this path towards not having an asset when they get to their 60s.
And I guess, again, that competency can be their downfall as well when it comes to a system that's so inflexible.
I mean, a lot of them, one of the women talked to me about how she made sure what she wore when she went into a housing or homelessness services office, she made sure she didn't dress too well. But she also didn't want to dress too daggy. She didn't want to look like a hobo, she said. But she didn't want to look like she didn't need it. And then she said, this sort of happens because I'm reasonably well spoken and I have to tone everything back.
Yeah.
And that also reverberates with them not being experienced in dealing with welfare sector because they haven't had a history of chronic homelessness. They've come to it very sharply at the end of, towards, you know, the latter stage of their life, and they're not experiencing how to present themselves.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Were a lot of the people you interviewed working mums when they were working? So while they were working and raising children, they were renting. Would this be?
Yeah.
So it's a when the work dries up or they become too, you know, of an age when it feels like it's too difficult to continue in the work
it
sector.
It can be ageism.
Yep.
You know, some of them would like to keep working. It can be a health issue.
Yep.
You know, a health issue could be an autoimmune condition, which means they can't front up every day for a full-time job.
Mm.
They can do bits and pieces, but they no longer can be a reliable full-time employee. And it's also being single in the housing market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's come to that now, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Where, you know, even a middling income. And, you know, these women often have been in and out of the workforce and a lot of part-time work because of their
because
care responsibility.
Raising children, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they end up sort of being punished for that, where they thought they were doing what they should be doing at those stages in their lives, putting the children first, making sure they had everything they needed, and somewhat ignoring their own needs.
And you also mentioned that the kind of products that are available through the welfare system, like bond loans and Commonwealth rent assistance and those sorts of things, aren't really appropriate. They're not helping in such a crazily expensive rental market.
No.
Yes.
Because they're ways of keeping people in private rentals.
Mm, which is still insecure.
Yeah, well, it's insecure when you've got no potential to earn more income.
Yeah.
You know, they're more set up for people who, as a launch pad, you know, that could add education and then get a better job or training, you know, younger people who've got that kind of future. But at that older age, they haven't got that to look forward to. So, yes, and a lot of them faced those sort of responses.
And the
ways to stay housed in the private market, which is a dead end for them.
And so a more appropriate option would be safe and age-appropriate housing. What were the thoughts of the older women that you spoke to around their ideal housing that they'd like to live in?
Well, a lot of them spoke about it not being too small because, you know, there's a set of standards, and it can be as small as a studio. A lot of them have got they've got their things in storage.
Yeah.
And you know, the 80-year-old actually knocked back a social housing opportunity because it had a mezzanine with a sort of ladder.
Oh dear.
And she couldn't have fitted her fridge, her you know, dining table. All the things she's kept in storage for so long, she couldn't have even fit them in. And then she sort of was punished because of that.
Yeah.
Her caseworker said, I don't think you need a caseworker because you're very competent. And then she had to go back and say, yes, I do need a caseworker. So she felt like she was punished for couch surfing, and then she felt she was punished for knocking back what she felt was inappropriate housing for an older woman.
Well, yeah, someone with a ladder.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, some sort of steep access to the mezzanine. Mm. Yeah, so I think the rent assistance, they talked about that a lot. And although it's gone up, Commonwealth rent assistance, its increase in relation to the increase in rents is nothing.
Yeah.
Doesn't touch the edges at all. So that could be something that could be addressed for that cohort, more appropriate rent assistance, if they indeed have to stay in the private rental market.
And you also mentioned that they like to live in social housing that's exclusively for women.
Well, there's a great fear around social housing with older women because you hear the worst of it because, you know, it has been residualised and often it's people with mental health issues that are in there, and that is a little bit daunting for them. So, yeah, they often talk about that, and some of the imagine housing outcomes, even for the advocates, are women-only kind of communities or older people-only communities.
Yeah.
That they feel would be more suitable.
Well, that's all been a great conversation, Therese, and we really appreciate the time that you've taken to come in and talk to us today, virtually, over the phone.
Yes.
If people, you finished your PhD last year, where can people have a read of your findings, or what's the next steps for you, and how can people find out more?
I am on the verge of finding that out myself, but I can make it available through you guys.
Yeah, okay, great.
So that might be the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
Because I've certainly been sending it off to all the participants. but, yes, I haven't there's a little process I have to go through to get it into the library, and I don't know whether that's open access, so... Why don't we do it through you?
Sure. Yeah, that'd be fantastic. We'd love to do that. And thanks so much for taking the time to speak to all of those older women. The more evidence that we can build through hearing stories like this, I think is really, really important for decision makers to hear when they're designing not just housing, but the housing support systems as well. So,
yeah. That's the idea, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the idea. So congratulations on finishing your PhD. And
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks,
Therese. City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9 a.m.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment,
to transport and planning and housing issues,
to privatisations and our utility services,
to building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
You've been listening to Raise the Roof on 3CR, and if you are at risk of homelessness and over 50, you can phone for assistance housing for the Aged Action Group on 1300 765 178.
That's all we have time for on this fortnight's show. A really great interview that we did, I thought. Nice to hear from people from other states not having a service like our amazing service. We're going to go out with a song, and this song is called Hysteria by Wet Lips. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Sponge, dry sponge, fill me up, I'll soak you up.